Support for the Exchange podcast from NHPR comes from you, our subscribers, and from
Dartmouth Hitchcock. Imagine nationally ranked healthcare in your community with convenient locations throughout northern New England. World-class providers are closer than you think. Visit dartmouthhitchcock.org to learn more. Dartmouth Hitchcock is here. And from
the Elm Street Group at Morgan Stanley, working with clients to create enduring financial value and a lasting impact through sustainable investing solutions. A local wealth management team with global insights. Find out more at the Elm Street Group at morganstanley.com.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. Alzheimer's. It causes memory loss, confusion, trouble speaking. It's also this country's sixth leading cause of death. And despite huge efforts in recent years, there's still no treatment or cure. And so a shift in focus seems to be underway, an emphasis on prevention and very early detection, more than a decade before symptoms show up, when it's a lot easier to slow the disease's progression. So in the Alzheimer's research community, there's a mix of frustration over many failed drug trials, but some excitement over the possibilities of prevention. Meanwhile, away from the science labs and out in the real world, those working with patients and their families say it's a tough slog finding appropriate and affordable care. Today in The Exchange, re-examining Alzheimer's. Let's get your stories and your questions in. The Exchange number is 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange. We have four guests with us. Melissa Grenier is here, regional manager of the state of New Hampshire for the Alzheimer's Association. She's also a licensed social worker with experience in cognitive and memory impairment. And Melissa, nice to have you. Thank you so much.
Good morning.
Also with us, Dr. Lynn Paintner. She's an internist and geriatric specialist at Concord Hospital. And Dr. Lynn Paintner, good to meet you. Thank you for your time.
You're welcome.
Also joining us, Dr. Daniel Seshpin. He's assistant professor of psychology at UNH Manchester and a clinical neuropsychologist with a specialist in dementia and sports-related traumatic brain injury. And Dr. Seshpin, welcome. Thank you.
You're welcome. Thank you.
And joining us from the Boston area is Dr. Jonathan Jackson, cognitive neuroscientist and instructor of neurology at Massachusetts General Hospital, where he specializes in Alzheimer's disease. And Dr. Jackson, thank you also for your time. We really appreciate it.
Oh, thank you, Lauren. Good morning.
Well, and Dr. Jackson, I want to start with you. Society has seen such progress with other diseases, AIDS, cancer, and so forth. And here we are with Alzheimer's. No cure. How come?
That's a great question. The answer is, as you might imagine, complicated. Well, first of all, I wanted to say that there has been a tremendous amount of progress in Alzheimer's disease research, and that's only accelerating over time. So, for example, I often give talks in the community about research updates on Alzheimer's disease. And if I wait more than 2 weeks between lectures, I have to update my slides because there have been significant breakthroughs in just that 2 week period. And it's been the case for I think several years now that the pace of acceleration has really picked up. One of the big challenges that we've had to overcome with Alzheimer's disease is figuring out where it starts, figuring out where to intervene. For many years, we thought of Alzheimer's disease as this problem of memory, of memory loss, and we tried to fix that by looking at the brain where memory was and trying to intervene there, only to find that the cures and treatments that we developed weren't effective enough. They might have tiny, tiny effects, but not enough to overwhelm or overcome some of the difficulties that we saw with families and their loved ones who suffer from the disease. So we kind of moved a little bit earlier. We tried to wait until people were first diagnosed with the disease and tried to intervene at that stage. And we found that we had a little bit more success, but still not quite enough. And so nowadays, our treatments and our options are looking more at the prevention stage of the disease. So before someone is diagnosed with Alzheimer's disease, even before someone's diagnosed with mild cognitive impairment, we're trying to say, let's try to intervene then. Let's think of Alzheimer's disease as a problem of plaques and tangles in the brain rather than a memory problem. And the hope is that in the next couple of years, we'll be able to announce some significant progress.
Well, it's interesting to hear you say that it's moving so quickly that you have to update your slides every couple of weeks. And just real quickly, Dr. Jackson, what is Alzheimer's and how is it different than broadly dementia?
Yes. So I'm going to give you the very academic perspective on that question. So I think when we talk about Alzheimer's disease, if you ask the four of us what our definition or how we see the disease, you might get four slightly different answers. But strictly speaking, Alzheimer's disease is the buildup of amyloid plaque and neurofibrillary tangles or tau tangles in the brain that leads to the destruction of brain cells. It tends to start off in parts of the brain that are responsible for the assembly of memory, and then it spreads throughout the brain over about 8 to 12 years. Now, dementia is frequently attributed to Alzheimer's disease in older adults. So for older adults over the age of 65, the leading cause of dementia is Alzheimer's disease. So dementia, I think the best way to frame that is that it's like saying that you have a headache. There are lots of reasons why you can have a headache, but for older adults over the age of 65, the leading cause of dementia tends to be Alzheimer's disease. But dementia is just a generic term that tells us that you have problems with your thinking and memory abilities. So it's not exactly any one disease, although Alzheimer's disease seems to be a leading cause of dementia.
Dr. Sashpin, what do you think about that first question I asked Dr. Jackson? What makes Alzheimer's so tough to cure? Again, we've made progress in a lot of other areas with other illnesses.
This is a really good, great question. So Alzheimer's disease probably starts decades before we see any symptoms. As Dr. Jackson mentioned, these bad proteins, these plaques, likely build up two, maybe three decades before we diagnose it. And so we don't even know that people have the disease yet. We have to wait, you know, a decade or more until they start to see symptoms. And by that time, it's probably too late, at least in the way that we've been trying to treat it currently. So I think that's a really big challenge, is how do we diagnose it very early on in the disease, long before it destroys brain cells, so that we can kind of bend the curve there and stop those cells from dying. If it's okay, I'd like to just talk a little bit about that brain pathology and what we think is going on, and a little bit about how we might diagnose that nowadays.
Sure, because I was going to ask you why some brains get Alzheimer's and some don't. So go ahead.
Absolutely. So these amyloid beta plaques are probably the first thing that appears in the disease. And unfortunately, they're probably building up in all of us as we get older. But in Alzheimer's disease, those patients are getting it at a much higher rate. They're building them up much quicker, and it's just more than our brain and our immune system can deal with. After these plaques build up, then we start to see neurons die, and we call those neurofibrillary tangles. And once those tangles die, and the cells in the brain start to die, and the brain starts to shrink, that's when we see symptoms. So we really want to treat the disease before the brain shrinks, before we see symptoms like that. In the last few years, there's been some interesting ways of trying to figure out who has these plaques in the brain long before they have symptoms, with some fancy brain imaging techniques, particularly called PET or positron emission tomography. And that does pick up amyloid beta plaques in the brain. But the tricky part is we're all getting those plaques as well. So we need to differentiate between those that have too many plaques that are going to go on and start the process to cause neurofibrillary tangles, and what is just normal amount of plaques in the human brain.
Well, and there's also the ethical question of, you know, who wants to go in and find out that they might get Alzheimer's disease in 20 years?
Absolutely, yes.
I mean, I'm sitting here listening to you think, and I'm going, I don't know. Would I really want to know that?
And particularly in our current state of science, where we don't have any disease-modifying treatments. We have treatments that can help with some of the symptoms, but we have nothing that's going to make, you know, change the course of the disease, to stop the brain from shrinking, anything like that. And it's a great question. You know, would you want to know?
Well, that's the thing. And so Dr. Lynn Paintner, what Dr. Jackson, Dr. Sashpin have told us about, there's a lot of research, but no cure. Given that, when someone is diagnosed with Alzheimer's, what helpful advice, what words can you offer them?
Well, it's quite dependent on who you're talking to, what they're experiencing themselves, and where they find themselves in the journey that is Alzheimer's disease, which is so different for different families and different individuals, different couples. It has such impact on how people live together and how people's long-term relationships develop and end, even. What can you say? One thing I think we should always keep in mind when we use the term dementia, and specifically Alzheimer's as the most common form of dementia. Dementia is not only to be thought of as problems with thinking and cognition and memory, it also implies that there's been a sufficient functional decline, problems in getting things done in your daily life that you need to do, to really cause impairment. And that's the distinction between dementia and these earlier stages of both Alzheimer's disease and other dementia-related diseases. So I tend to not think so much about Alzheimer's specifically, and I tend to more think about cognitive impairment as a class of conditions. We often see mixed pathology in the brain when looking under the microscope, and there's different things that contribute to how fast people tend to build up these abnormal proteins that result in inflammation and destruction of brain cells. So, you know, some of the things that we can talk about are how are the ways that you could, in your lifestyle choices, reduce the rapidity with which you develop these changes in the brain, and that is
often... How do we slow it down?
How do you slow it down? And turns out that there are certain choices that do seem to make a difference. People who are very active, who walk a lot, don't get as rapid a buildup. People who have very high risks for cardiovascular disease in general, such as smoking, such as diabetes, such as history of vascular disease, high cholesterol, those things make the Alzheimer's changes more likely. We see vascular changes in the brain that seem to potentiate the development of the Alzheimer's disease. So there are things that make a difference. But, you know, it's nothing your grandmother couldn't tell you. It's nothing really that new.
A healthy
don't
lifestyle,
smoke, you know,
right.
Get some
maintain
exercise.
A good weight and
yes,
so forth.
Exactly.
So you don't have any fancy new drugs to give people when they get this frightening diagnosis?
No, we sure don't. And, you know, that's our reality. We're not able to medically make a life-changing decision or contribution. We are able to help. And depending, you know, it has a lot to do with how people view their interest in medicalizing their dementia care, how much benefit or how much cost and potential side effects people are interested in tolerating for a potential small benefit, because that's all we've got right now available. We don't have something that can turn the clock back. We do have some medicines that can be helpful with some of the more difficult behavioral problems that develop as people get more severely ill. Again, we don't have great drugs for that. We have drugs that have a number of potential side effects, even black box warnings. But we're getting, I think, better and better as clinicians at choosing the safest possible medicines to help with agitation, anxiety, and sometimes even the hallucinations or delusional thinking that can accompany a late stage.
Managing the symptoms. And I've
Precisely.
Heard about angry outbursts and anxiety and all that.
Right.
Melissa, I wanted to bring you into this as well. Same question that I asked Dr. Lynn Paintner. Given that there's no cure, what's the next step for the individual and the family when they receive this diagnosis?
Well, we'd love to think at the Alzheimer's Association that their number one option would be us. That's not always the case, but that's why we work so hard to inform people in the community about what we do and that we provide our programs and services at no cost to them, which seeing as this is the number one most expensive disease process in the United States right now, I think it's really important for people to have low cost or no cost options when it comes to getting educated. I think education for me is the most impactful way to reach people that are newly diagnosed or their family members or caregivers, and also just in terms of the overall healthcare workforce, especially here in New Hampshire, where it can be lacking in some rural areas of our state. So I think one of the biggest things that I see, even with someone who's halfway through the disease process, they really still need a lot of education and emotional support. Sometimes there aren't a lot of resources I can suggest to a family, but them just knowing that we're here and we're available 24 hours a day can be incredibly reassuring and can provide them with something at that particular moment in time.
How do you view this focus on prevention that Dr. Jackson and Dr. Seshpin talked about?
I think it's incredibly important. I've been working with people for about 14, 15 years with the disease, and I agree with, in terms of my observations, that people seem to, by the time they get diagnosed, they're past early stage oftentimes. And I think a lot of that has to do with the fact that we haven't talked about this disease as much over the years. We have in the past decade or so, I'd say. We've had a huge increase in public awareness, but there's still a lot of work to be done.
Go ahead. Yeah.
No, so I'll leave it at that.
Well, and Dr. Jackson, I have to ask you this. When I started reading about what you and others have been saying about, you know, the emphasis on prevention. So as Dr. Seshpin described, you have a little bit more hope of staving this off. I thought, OK, that's great. But what about somebody who's suffering right now? I mean, is this focus on prevention forgetting the 5 million people who already are in the throes of this disease?
Not even remotely. So what part of the work that my research group does is we also run a number of clinical trials. And so our highest profile clinical trials are focused on prevention. So things like the A4 study and upcoming clinical trials like the early study really are looking at intervening. However, that kind of leaves aside the 10 or 12 protocols that we're currently running to test cures for people who already have a diagnosis of mild cognitive impairment, mild or even moderate Alzheimer's disease. So just because the research is looking at trying to prevent Alzheimer's disease doesn't mean that we've given up on individuals who already have a diagnosis. It's just that we feel that we'll get the biggest bang for our buck with the fewest side effects by trying to prevent the disease. As with any progressive disease, it's better to cure it earlier rather than later. But that is to say that we are still trying a lot of potential disease-modifying therapies, focusing on either the amyloid process or increasingly focusing on the tau process, which is the other aspect of the disease that we haven't talked about as much. Trying to intervene in one or both of these areas might prove promising even in symptomatic individuals.
So working on both fronts, basically, you're saying?
Yes. Yeah, absolutely.
The number for you to join us with your questions, comments, and of course, personal experiences with Alzheimer's disease is 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter if you'd like. Again, our number, 1-800-892-6477. Facebook and Twitter are NHPR Exchange. Dr. Seshpin, do you want to jump in on that question too? The renewed focus on prevention doesn't mean that we're leaving, you know, other people behind who already have this disease.
Absolutely. And I kind of want to, you know, take it back a step and kind of talk about what we're doing in those clinical trials. And I think that can kind of be insightful. And it sort of goes back a little bit to what Dr. Lynn Paitner said, in that when you look at the brains of people who have unfortunately passed away with dementia, there's a lot of disease pathology in there. Maybe it's Alzheimer's disease, but more commonly, we see multiple diseases in there. We see, you know, Alzheimer's disease and vascular dementia, or maybe we see some of the changes from other dementias. And so to come up with a good treatment, I think we need to get really pure cases, and we need to get individuals who truly just have Alzheimer's disease so that we can see if these new drugs are beneficial in helping them. There's a lot of overlap between the different dementias. One that we see a lot about in the news and I've studied myself is about chronic traumatic encephalopathy, so dementia that's caused from repetitive concussions. We've seen it in football players and things like that.
Sure. Guys in their late 40s, early 50s who already have brain diseases that much older people typically have.
Absolutely. They're very young, and their changes look like they, you know, someone who was in their 60s and 70s. What most people don't know about that disease is that the predominant pathology is the same protein that's bad in Alzheimer's disease. It's this tau protein. And they likely share some overlap in that in Alzheimer's disease, amyloid beta plaque is building up and causing these taus and these tau proteins. In chronic traumatic encephalopathy, it's likely getting hit in the head a lot, causes this change in the neurons, which causes the neurofibrillary tangles.
Wow. All right. A lot more to untangle in just a moment. And we'll start taking your calls, too. So join us, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. And coming up, we'll get your questions and comments in. So stay with us.
I Ideas come naturally to writers.
I wish.
But how are they with deadlines?
I would say probably 5 times in the history of my column have I gotten it done during the day on Monday. And it's the most incredible feeling. Like, if you could distill that feeling and grind it into a powder, I would snort it.
Apparently, they're just like the rest of us. Whether you're looking for inspiration or commiseration, subscribe to the 10-Minute Writer's Workshop on iTunes or Google Play.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, the latest on Alzheimer's disease, including, as we're hearing, a focus on prevention. The Exchange number is 1-800-892-6477. Send an email to exchange@nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange. We have 4 guests. Melissa Grenier is with the Alzheimer's Association, regional director for the state of New Hampshire. Dr. Jonathan Jackson is on the phone. He's a cognitive neuroscientist at Massachusetts General Hospital. Dr. Lynn Paintner is here. She's a geriatric specialist and internist at Concord Hospital. And Dr. Daniel Seshpin, assistant professor of psychology at UNH Manchester and a clinical neuropsychologist. Again, the number for you to join us, 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Before we go to our listeners, all of you, Dr. Lynn Paintner, I'd love your thoughts, too, on this idea of prevention and how we need to look at it more broadly.
Well, prevention is going to ultimately be where we want to get to, and it's such important work that's being done in these very early stages of the disease. You can imagine it's difficult to see into the brain, so we first have to develop the techniques to see these plaques and tangles that are only visible right now for most of us under the microscope. So prevention is important. Lifestyle choices, like I was mentioning, is important. And then we can think about prevention of some of the bad things that happen during dementia. And I guess that's kind of where I've spent a lot of my time with many colleagues at Concord Hospital, focusing on one of the bad things that happens a lot to people with dementia, which is called delirium. And I'll just put in a brief plug for really understanding this extremely common and dangerous and frightening condition. Delirium is when people have changes in their thinking, when they become acutely confused or even fearful as the result of a medical event, a physiological stressor like an illness, an injury, or even a new medicine. And people with dementia are highly susceptible to developing this problem. So this is something to think about when, for example, if you have an elderly, frail family member who suddenly, in the context of, say, an operation or a severe pneumonia, suddenly is not themselves and just talking in a paranoid fashion or very fearful, this is a delirium. It's not their dementia. It's a new thing layered on top, and it's a whole important topic to remember, but I think we don't explain it all that well always in medical settings.
Wow, so something even more to figure out.
So that's something that there's a lot of research, fortunately, now about that might be interesting to get into at some point.
Well, and I'm interested in what you said about right now you can only discover these plaques and so forth, tangles, under a microscope of a person who's died and you're examining their brain. Is that right?
Well, not entirely. The folks like Dr. Jackson are developing newer ways to look at these things, but that's been the challenge.
That's been the challenge. Dr. Jackson, you want to jump in real quick on that? How do you look at someone's brain?
It is true that the gold standard for diagnosing something like Alzheimer's disease tends to be postmortem or under the microscope. But we also recognize that's not particularly useful for people who are worried about having the disease now or maybe in the early stages of the disease. So, the most promising diagnostic technique that our group is working on relies on PET imaging. So it was mentioned earlier, the positron emission tomography scan. So basically, we can put a radio tracer into your bloodstream. It will go up into your brain, and if you have any of these amyloid plaques, in theory, it's supposed to bind to them and fluoresce, so it'll light up, and you can see how much amyloid someone has in their brain. We've also developed some novel tracers looking at the tau protein as well, because one of the things that we've recognized is that it's it's less about the amyloid and more about the combination of amyloid and tau, or maybe even it's about where the tau is in the brain. That kind of helps us understand some of the clinical and cognitive symptoms of the disease that people have. So the hope is that if these clinical trials that we're conducting are relatively promising, that we'll be able to start using something like a PET scan to diagnose the disease with some reasonable degree of confidence.
And I asked Dr. Seshpin this earlier, I think, Dr. Jackson. Mm-hmm. I got to ask you, too. I mean, again, okay, so let's say you develop a gold standard of Alzheimer's detection. There's some real questions about people subjecting themselves to that. I mean, do you really want to know, given that it's incurable?
Right. So, you know, one of the things that that our A4 trial is also tackling at the same time is we've got an ethics sub-study that's tacked on to the larger clinical trial because we want to know if it's useful to give people that information. So one of the problems with the PET scan is that we don't know how much amyloid or how much tau is too much. We don't know exactly where those cutoff scores are going to be. So one of the challenges that our group has over the next few years is to determine where those cutoffs are going to be and at what point we should intervene, at what point we should try to tell the family that you have elevated amyloid or tau burden in your brain. We don't know if that means you have mild cognitive impairment. We don't know if that means you have Alzheimer's disease in a purer form or if that's more of a mixed dementia. So there are ethical questions that I think arise. But at the same time, I think it's important to recognize that our best bet at combating this disease, I think as all of the panelists have agreed, is with a focus on prevention. And the longer lead time you have when you know, the more that you can do. So right now, it's true that there aren't any currently available disease-modifying drugs on the market, but hopefully that won't be true for too much longer. So within maybe the next 5 to 7 years, we might have a class of disease-modifying therapies that are good at preventing the disease, but maybe not necessarily treating the disease.
Okay, Dr.
And so
Seshpin,
we still
yeah.
have that.
Oh,
yeah,
sorry. Go ahead, Dr. Jackson.
That, yeah, I just wanted to say that we still have that ethical dilemma, but as our treatments look more and more promising and then spill over into reality, I think having that lead time of knowing as early as possible will be even more important.
Well, that's the point you made earlier, Dr. Seshpin, that the earlier,
yes.
the better.
Absolutely. And so I just wanted to highlight and just mention quickly for all the listeners about what this amyloid beta is, because we've been talking about it for a little bit now. But a lot of questions I get is like, where does it come from? Is it from something in the building that I work or something like that?
And again, why me and not you?
Absolutely. And so amyloid beta plaques are made from a protein that's in all of our brains. It makes up part of our cells, part of our neurons. And something happens to it that changes it and clumps it into this kind of mush that gets in the way of brain functioning. So for, you know, again, I just wanted to highlight for everyone, I get these questions a lot. Amyloid beta plaques are part of our normal cell that something has transformed it into this abnormal cluster in the brain.
All right, let's go to our listeners. Lots of questions. Again, the number 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange. Again, the number 1-800-892-6477. And Todd is calling from Amherst. Hi, Todd. You're on the Exchange. Welcome.
Oh, hi, thanks. Yeah, I'm a neuropsychologist, and I assess people all the time for dementia. And two thoughts. One, I think there's a delay in diagnosis because family doesn't often recognize how far their loved one has deteriorated because they've slowly assumed all of the responsibilities without kind of realizing. And then two, I get very frustrated with the medical community. Most physicians are not adept or trained at how to assess cognition. And they will often say, well, do you know the president's name? Do you know the year? Oh, you're fine. Or if they do think that there's a memory problem, they'll tell the family that it's normal. And we never would tell somebody that hypertension is normal. It's common, but it's not normal. So I get very frustrated with that. And they also will tell them that there's no treatment. And there is some evidence to show that if you start people on these medications early, and they have some right constellation of other features, that some people do respond in terms of not developing some of the behavior changes and things that we see as it progresses later on. So I just wanted to share those two comments.
Boy, it's good to hear from you, Todd, especially given your experience. What do you think, Dr. Lynn Paintner?
I can really relate to that point of view. I think it's true that it's a little hard to know how to talk to families. Families themselves are, of course, not necessarily looking for an illness explanation for changes in the behavior that they notice in their family members. In fact, it's quite common for them to attribute changes in behavior to relationship issues. And so that makes it really, you know, a really challenging situation. Doctors respond to what their patients tell them, and a lot of times nobody comes with you to the doctor normally. You know, so you have the person who's losing their memory and their cognitive abilities come into the doctor and not necessarily reporting those things. So we need to screen, and Medicare is actually, to its credit, recommending screening with some somewhat less simplistic approaches than just, do you know the president? And we do pick up some early changes in memory. And then I'll tell you, it's a challenge how to go the next step, because you do want to know what their experience is. How impactful is this for the function of the person? But I think that these are really important observations that Todd's making.
Yeah, thank you, Todd. What about family dynamics, Melissa?
I was nodding my head the entire time that gentleman was speaking. So I do agree that family members often come to us and they've never sought out services or support, and their loved one has been dealing with this for an incredibly long period of time. And I think family dynamics and just frankly, the personality of the person and their caregivers themselves. I mean, some people are very stubborn. Other people want to know every piece of information about their disease that that they've been diagnosed with. So it can absolutely be a struggle. I talk to families all the time about any time they have a concern about a change in memory or their loved one's memory or thinking or functioning, they absolutely should go see their doctor. I tell them to run, not walk, because if I use the example of if I had some lesion on my arm, I wouldn't just say, you know, it's probably just because I'm 73, I'm getting a little older, you know, it's probably just that. I'd be like running to the doctor wanting to know what the heck this is. So I think it is really important for people to be paying attention. We do a lot of education around the warning signs related to Alzheimer's disease, and I think that that helps people understand what those red flags are.
Although I can understand why people, in a way, Melissa, would want to not run to the doctor, because the doctor might tell you have an incurable disease that's going to rob you of your memory. I mean, who wants to get that news?
But the likelihood, honestly, what I've found, and I'm not a physician, so I don't diagnose people, but a lot of times it may be something related to a change in their medication, or their thyroid is off, or they have depression that's been untreated, or lots of other things. So I tell people that I wouldn't necessarily assume that it's Alzheimer's disease if they're having some small changes, but they should have them addressed, the sooner the better.
I've got a bunch of emails here, folks, on a related topic, and that is, Dr. Seshpin, I'll turn to you, whether Alzheimer's is runs through families. So here's Nancy on Facebook who says, my mother was diagnosed with Alzheimer's at about 80, but we noticed changes about 5 years earlier. Nancy asks, is Alzheimer's an inherited disease or more a lifestyle disease? Every time I can't recall a word, the I'm next thought goes through my head. Also, Sue in Bow says, please tell us about the genetic factors in Alzheimer's. Please speak about the types that impact multiple family members earlier in life. And someone else, Anonymous, wanted to also know about the genetic component of this early onset Alzheimer's. So thanks to everybody who emailed Nancy on Facebook. Dr. Seshpin, what do you know?
Wonderful questions. Wonderful, wonderful questions. So Alzheimer's disease, there are genes associated with developing the late onset Alzheimer's disease that we all typically think of as the condition. It doesn't mean that if you have those genes that you will get Alzheimer's, but there is an association. So the gene that's particularly associated with that form of Alzheimer's is called APOE, or apolipoprotein. And you get certain kind of types of combinations of this gene, one from mom, one from dad. And some combinations can give you an increased risk of getting Alzheimer's disease. But it does not mean you will get the disease. But let me talk now about a different type, because there is a different type. There is a genetic mutation version of Alzheimer's disease in that if you have this gene, you will get the disease. This is incredibly uncommon. It represents less than 1% of all the cases of Alzheimer's disease. But in those people with those genes, they will get the disease. So those diseases are called presenilin-1 and APP and things like that. And we find them in pockets around the world where there wasn't a lot of genetic diversity. So we see a big group in Colombia. There's some in our local area up here, up in the Boston area, the New England area. But again, that type is very, very unusual, but it does occur. And let me just say one last thing about that. Those early onset types, that pure genetic type, might be one of the ways we can come up with a cure for this disease. If we know you're going to get the condition, maybe now we can start a trial on somebody decades before any symptoms present. It could give hope for the future.
Well, thank you for those emails again, and Facebook comment from you, Nancy. And let's go back to the phones. Wendy's in Nashua. Hi, Wendy. You're on the air. Welcome.
Hi. How you doing?
Good.
Question about diet. I saw a show on public TV not that long ago about some nuns, I think in Europe. They agreed that after they died, they would dissect their brains. They did find amyloid plaques and things, but they were functioning very well. They kind of seemed to attribute some to diet and keeping their brain active. What kind of a diet would that be? Is it helpful? Or
yeah, you know, Wendy, we should definitely talk about this because Dr. Jackson, to you first, I think, I have read a lot about the impact of diet in terms of prevention or slowing the progression of Alzheimer's. Go ahead.
Okay, so I have a feeling this is a question that just about all the panelists are going to weigh in on. So I will keep my comments restricted to just what I know from a purely research perspective rather than kind of an everyday lifestyle one or a clinical perspective. So the study that was being referred to, I think, is a really great study. It's actually a data set that I cut my teeth on when I was a graduate student in St. Louis. So what we learned about that study was a couple of things, and I want to just very quickly unpack that. So one of the things that we learned from that study that we didn't really understand before is that a lot of these nuns had enough amyloid in their brains to meet the criterion for Alzheimer's disease, but they didn't show a lot of the cognitive and clinical symptoms that we associate with Alzheimer's dementia. And so that was the point that I made earlier, is that there is a kind of a decoupling between how much amyloid is in your brain and how much functional loss you experience. So we realize that the pathology of the disease is more than just amyloid. It's also how destructive this amyloid is and how much amyloid is there in presence with this tau protein that we heard about earlier. Now, with regard to diet, that is looked at as one of the protective factors. There are other protective factors that are kind of loosely grouped under these variables that are called brain reserve or cognitive reserve. And so we might save that discussion for a little bit later on. But when it comes to diet, a lot of research in the Alzheimer's community has focused on something called the MIND diet, or which is kind of a variant of the Mediterranean diet combined with a low sodium diet as well. And the research seems to suggest that for some reasons that remain unclear, it might have to do with some epigenetic factors, that a diet that is a kind of rich in vegetables and low in sodium, and you give up all of your animal fats and you try to use olive oil wherever you can. But these kinds of diets do seem to lower your risk of dementia. So again, there is that decoupling between the Alzheimer's disease pathology and the actual dementia. And most of the research has focused on that functional decline that people see that's commonly associated with Alzheimer's disease. It does seem to be that a diet like this will lower your risk for developing dementia, even over like a 4 or 5 year period. What's great about it is that a lot of these clinical trials that have looked at it have found a really nice dose response effect. So if you do a little bit of the diet, you see a little bit of the benefit. If you do a lot of the diet, you see a lot of the benefit. So it's one of those things that is really easy to embrace. So you don't have to be great at the diet. Obviously, the better you are, it's all for the best. But
well, super interesting.
It's still and something good.
Got some more listeners who I think want to pick up on that point. So we'll go to you after a short break. Stay with us.
Ideas come naturally to writers.
I wish.
But how are they with deadlines?
I would say probably 5 times in the history of my column have I gotten it done during the day on Monday. And it's the most incredible feeling. Like, if you could distill that feeling and grind it into a powder, I would snort it.
Apparently, they're just like the rest of us. Whether you're looking for inspiration or commiseration, subscribe to the 10-Minute Writer's Workshop on iTunes or Google Play.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoi. Today in The Exchange, the latest research on Alzheimer's disease, a renewed focus on prevention, also the day-to-day experiences of families and caregivers. The Exchange number is 1-800-892-6477. And we'd love to get your questions, comments, of course, personal experiences in. 1-800-892-6477. Send email to exchange at nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange. And all of you, let's go right back to our listeners. Ryan's in Plymouth. Hi, Ryan. You're on the air. Welcome.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Sure.
So I'm an occupational therapist, and I've worked personally with this population. And so I just wanted to mention something along the lines. I'm so glad they brought up the Nunn study. And there are things that you can do right now as a maturing adult in terms of lifelong learning, journaling. So along with being physically active, being mentally active is very important. And I saw with a lot of the people I worked with that if they were mentally active and maintained connections in the community with peers and people who challenged them mentally, they tended to have more vivacity and they were more able to do the things they needed to do. So in terms of function, if you are challenging yourself cognitively, your cognitive function is perhaps less likely to fall off, no matter what's going on inside your brain.
Ryan, yeah. No, I'm really glad you raised the question. And, you know, Dr. Lynn Paintner, years ago, we were all told, do the crossword puzzles every day. And I have a friend who loyally does the crossword puzzle every day. I actually really don't like crossword puzzles, but I do other things. What about Ryan's point about staying physically active and mentally active? And I wonder if those nuns had those social intellectual connections. I mean, they're probably, you know, looking at spiritual texts and discussing the meaning. I mean, that's got to be intellectually rigorous.
Absolutely. They had a rich social environment. And I think what Ryan brings up is such an important point, this idea that we're learning how important our social networks are. It's not just our cognitive stimulation that we get through that, but we get emotional stimulation. We practice being empathetic. We practice functions of our brain that are deeply human and deeply important. And somehow, this is protective to our health. And so, you know, I don't think we can underemphasize the really basics that we were alluding to a little bit ago of there are some things that each person can do. Not smoking, controlling blood pressure, controlling blood sugar, looking at diet and eating lots of fruits and vegetables and all the things that we kind of know to be good for us in general. But don't forget maintaining relationships and keeping, sort of make a point of social contact.
Well, in terms of people who already have the disease, and this one's for you, Melissa. Gail emailed us earlier. She works with a group called Senior Helpers of the Greater Seacoast. And lots of points here. I won't read all of them. But Gail says, Senior Helpers focuses on what our clients can do and not what they can no longer do. One of the most challenging aspects of supporting someone who is living with dementia, Gail says, is to develop daily routines and activities that are interesting, meaningful, doable, valued by the person who is experiencing so many changes due to the condition. And Gail, thank you for that email. And I wonder what you think about this, Melissa. You know, helping someone stay engaged even though they already have this disease.
I think it goes back to education. We focus on a model of care called habilitation therapy at the Alzheimer's Association. And I teach families it and we teach professionals in the community about it. And it really has to do with focusing on what a person still can do. So promoting successes and independence and decreasing distress and frustration, you know, by sometimes focusing on what the person can't do anymore. I think people do feel more successful. And I use the use it or lose it kind of mentality that someone needs to use their communication skills. They need to use their social skills. They need to continue to wash the dishes and participate and contribute. They feel good about that. And it's also in some way, shape, or form supportive to the household and to the caregiver as well. It's a little bit less they have to do. And the impact on caregivers, of course, with this disease is absolutely tremendous. So I think it is good overall for the person with the disease in terms of their emotional and mental well-being. But it goes back to the person who's caring for that individual. The person who is the caregiver has the ability to change their interaction and their approach to that person, to encourage them in certain ways, create that meaningful and structured environment.
Well, and Gil also points out that when you're caring for somebody with dementia, it's important to know who they were before their brain became afflicted, she says. You know, what did they like to do? Walk on the beach, visit museums, cook, garden, listen to music. I mean, so it isn't just here's a nice adult daycare center and, you know, go paint. If you didn't like painting before you had Alzheimer's, you're not going to like it now.
Yeah, absolutely. It's really important to connect with the person, to know what their functional abilities are now, but also to know who they were. Were they an opera singer in Germany and did they immigrate here? You know, were they a farmer? And that will help lead the caregiver or the family member into meaningful and engageful activities.
Let's go back to our listeners, Paul in Manchester. Hi, Paul. You're on the air. Welcome. Thanks for calling in.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Sure.
I just wanted to make a comment about the effects of certain medications on giving you Alzheimer-like symptoms. My father died of Alzheimer's at the age of 89. My mom at 91, she had dementia. And a few years ago when I was in my late 50s, I was experiencing some really difficult memory problems. And I was very nervous that maybe it was in my genes that I had early onset Alzheimer's.
Sure. I can see why you'd feel that way.
And my niece talked to me about it. She had done some studies. The medication was for my cholesterol. And she indicated that these studies showed that half the people with heart attacks and heart disease have high cholesterol and half have regular cholesterol. So there was really no correlation between the cholesterol and these heart diseases. She convinced me to get off the medication for the cholesterol. And when I got off the medication, my memory came back.
Wow.
Everything came back. It was like night and day.
So, Paul, you were taking anti-cholesterol medication, and once you went off of it, your memory improved.
Yep. Everything came back.
That's amazing. Dr. Seshpin, you can't talk about this specific instance, but I do wonder if there are certain medications. People take so many medications these days that might impair memory.
Yeah, so let me give a little bit of answer to that, and then maybe I'll pass it to Dr. Lynn Painter, who might have a little bit more insight in it. But one thing we know about Alzheimer's disease, and we mentioned this earlier, is that there is a mixed pathology, including vascular disease and vascular dementia. So in other words, something going on with the vessels in the brain that leads to dementia. And changes in vascular changes in the brain are predictive of conversion from kind of a normal cognitive function to dementia. So statins have done a fantastic job in changing, in helping with cardiovascular health and probably staving off dementia in some cases, or at least prolonging it. With that said, I have heard of cases of people taking statins who have reported severe cognitive deficits.
Really?
And I don't know enough about that, so that's why I'll pass that to Dr. And I apologize for putting you on the spot.
It is something that's reported, memory trouble. It's not something I hear a lot in the office. A lot of people are on statins. They're getting bad press these days because of some of these concerns. And I certainly think the bottom line is any medicine can cause problems, and there is no free lunch with pharmaceuticals. So if you suspect, if you have a new problem, drugs are always something to suspect, and it's always worth trying to see if you can eliminate an unexplained symptom by eliminating a medicine. Statins are an important contribution to our cardiovascular health, but they're not for everybody. So this was such an important thing that Paul found out about himself. But he's probably in a minority in terms of having that reaction. But nevertheless, when it happens to you, then it's 100%, and
wow,
you need to figure it out. So he was fortunate to get that tip. There's many medicines that can cause memory problems, thinking trouble. A lot of the medicines that are used for anxiety can cause different difficulties with memory. whole host of medicines, actually, so we always need to be suspicious.
Here's an email from Kate, who says, in a family where two generations are believed to have early onset Alzheimer's with severe symptoms showing up in their 50s, should the third generation be tested? Does the disease run in families? And Kate, thank you for the email. And Dr. Jackson, we talked about this before, you know, the ethics of testing and also the genetic component, but a lot of our listeners have that question.
So I would say that if there is a strong tradition, I guess a strong history of Alzheimer's disease specifically, then it does behoove younger generations to go and get tested, especially if they have that concern. But again, you know, like some of the other doctors have mentioned, genes aren't necessarily destiny. So one of the things that we've really learned recently is that you know, you can have a gene that modifies for the disease. Especially for the late onset Alzheimer's disease, that's the APOE gene that we heard about a little earlier. But at the same time, you know, these other genes that do confer 100% risk
Dr. Jackson, I'm going to jump in on there because we're having a hard time with your phone. But I think he said genes are not destiny, and I'm happy to hear him say that, Dr. Seshpin.
Yeah, I heard the same thing. And I think the last point that before he cut off there was that these other genes that I'd mentioned earlier are very, very unusual. They're very rare. And so, you know, it's most likely that even if you've had the disease in your family for a couple of generations, that you do not have this genetic variant. It's a very unusual, very rare one, but could be good for developing future treatments. You know, whether or not to get genetic testing is a very difficult question.
Right. Well, and can the average person afford genetic testing?
Yeah, so
does insurance cover that?
So some genetic testing like APOE, which is associated with that late onset version, is actually quite affordable and quite cheap. The other types are not.
All right, let's go back to our listeners. Angela's in Bedford. Hi, Angela. You're on the exchange. Thanks for calling us.
Hi. Some of the questions I have been answered, and this is a wonderful show, so thank you very much for letting me ask a question. We recently lost a beloved family member at the age of 53. She was diagnosed and was already had a brain full of plaque or calcifications, as they said, 4 years ago, and died very rapidly. And so having seen on PBS Dr. Amen, who says that, you know, psychology, et cetera, and psychiatry are the only professions who don't look at the organ they're treating, I'm wondering, is there any hope that brain scans can become a part of, you know, like your yearly physical or diagnosis, you know, so that we can become aware of the early look at the brain in a life and then seeing changes? Is there any hope of that, or is that much too expensive?
Wow, Angela, what a good question. Dr. Jackson, so in addition to being, you know, weighed at your annual physical and they check your cholesterol and maybe they check a couple other things, you get your brain scanned. What do you think? I love that question.
That's a great question, and it's actually something that we are working on in my research group. So we did talk about the promise of the PET scan. However, those are still a little intrusive and a little expensive. My guess is that someday those will be one of the best ways to be diagnosed while you're still alive, you know, without necessarily having those memory problems. We're also exploring whether there is anything promising with an MRI. So that's just like a standard magnetic resonance imaging scanner that won't necessarily, doesn't necessarily have that invasive component that PET does. So far, the evidence is not quite as strong with MRI. It's not quite as definitive as it is with PET. But it's actually the hope of my research group that we can generate a kind of a pattern of clear differences between healthy aging and maybe, you know, pathological aging in the case of Alzheimer's disease, so that you could go and potentially have an MRI maybe once every 5 or 10 years to look for evidence of this disease.
Well, Angela, thank you for the question, and I'm sorry to hear about your loved one. 53 is really, really young to die from Alzheimer's. Here's a question from Pam. I'll throw it to you, Dr. Lynn Paintner. Has there been any connection of sleep deprivation to Alzheimer's? What do you think? We hear a lot about sleep deprivation and how it's tied to heart disease and strokes and all sorts of problems.
Yeah, not getting enough sleep is really bad for you. I'm not aware of any studies that have specifically looked at sleep and Alzheimer's. I know that it's not good when I don't get a lot of sleep in terms of my thinking and memory, and I bet you anything that it does contribute. It's part of the kind of healthy lifestyle that, looked at as a totality, really does seem to make a difference. But I don't know, maybe one of the other panelists is familiar with some specific research about that.
All right, something else to look into. Dr. Seshpin, no?
No.
Dr. Jackson?
Actually, there's a huge body of research that links sleep with Alzheimer's disease. And a lot of this is actually being done, if listeners want to research the work of David Holtzman at Washington University in St. Louis. He is one of the, I think, the leading pioneers of sleep and Alzheimer's disease. It turns out that there's a whole system in the brain called the glymphatic system that is active while you're asleep. And one of the jobs of the glymphatic system is to clear out things like amyloid in your brain.
Oh, my goodness.
And it's really good at doing that when you're young. But as we get older, one of the things we recognize is that our sleep quality changes. We sleep less well and we sleep for less time. So one of the hypotheses that contributes to maybe a risk of Alzheimer's disease is some disruption in this glymphatic system that's kind of controlled by these helper cells called glial cells in the brain. And so we also know that individuals who there was a study published, I think, about 3 weeks ago that suggested that individuals who have a sudden change in the amount of sleep that they get may be at much higher risk, maybe twice as much, twice the risk of developing something like Alzheimer's disease as those who have relatively stable or steady sleep patterns. Now, this is
wow, that's really interesting.
Yeah, exactly.
And it actually relates to a show we did earlier this week on digital addiction and how people who sleep with their phones right by their beds don't get as much sleep, and more people are doing this. So the message is probably from the doctors, Dr. Seshpin, put the phone downstairs or in a drawer and get a good night's sleep for your brain's health and everything else.
Absolutely.
Well, all of you, is there any, I guess I'll bring you into this, Melissa, any last message that you want to leave us with as sort of representing, you know, someone who supports families and individuals with Alzheimer's right now?
I would just say that to the community, to the listeners, to medical practitioners, please use us as a resource, not only for, you know, for the medical profession, they can use it themselves. Anybody can call us if they need something as simple as a support group list or if they are having an urgent issue, placing mom or dad in a nursing home, whatever they need, we can either support them and help guide them and in terms of planning for the future. And our toll-free number and website, I'm sure, will be linked with this program.
We'll put it at nhpr.org for sure. Melissa, thank you for being here.
Thank you.
Dr. Jackson, thank you for your time.
Oh, thank you. I appreciate it.
Dr. Lynn Painter, it's good to meet you. Thank you.
Thanks so much.
And Dr. Seshpin, thanks a lot. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
This is The Exchange on NHPR.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. Hey, if you like what you heard, spread the word. Please give us a review on iTunes to help other listeners find us. And thanks.